And we are live. Good Monday afternoon, folks, and welcome to episode 3711. Today's episode is called Deals, Conspiracies, and the Enrollment Cliff. I've got a lot of stuff for you guys today. Most of it's very temporal, kind of current events-y stuff and things like that. We're gonna dig into things differently than the mainstream media ever does, as we typically do. Because if you're like mainstream media, there's literally no reason for anybody to pay attention to you on alternative media. And because let's be honest, if you believe the mainstream media at this point, you have an IQ under 75. I'm sorry, but you do. You may not literally, but functionally, you're a sub-75 IQ if you trust the mainstream media. Now, you guys know what I mean when I say that. I don't mean that everything they say is a lie. I said what I mean is everything that they say should be taken as a lie until proven to be factual, because most of what you hear from them is not factual. Now, some of the stuff that you will hear from me today, they're saying it's factual. In fact, they're even my source for it, but we have to filter through it. And then we have to figure out what it actually means to regular everyday people like us instead of people that live in little glass houses. So what exactly do we have on the agenda today? The EU deal. Now, this is not me pumping up arms, man. This is just simply if I'm evaluating who won the negotiation between Eurocaren, Ursula von der Leyen, right, and Archman, Archman put her over his knee and spanked her. And I know it's a bad graphic to get in your head, but basically he made her say, thank you, sir, may I have another, until he got a deal that was so good that people looking at it can't believe the EU made the deal. It was basically, here's everything you asked for, and we get nothing out of it, except less than the punishment you promised, right? Like, we'll cut the punishment in half if you'll shut up and do everything we say. Okay. I mean, really, it's kind of like if, you know, you're a kid, and you're like, okay, look, I need you to do all these things, and they're like, I'm not going to do it. And you go, okay, 2 weeks grounded. And they go, and you go, I'll tell you what, I'll make it 1 week grounding, and you still have to do all the things. And they say, okay. I mean, it was that bad. The EU, it's not even countries. It's like a group of countries. France is pissed. Who cares? The France is pissed. That's probably even better. And what I'm going to tell you is what that's going to lead to. Money, money, money. Like a rich guy in a strip bar doling out the bills with trade deals. Just as I said was going to happen a few weeks ago. In fact, maybe a month and a half ago. That we were going to have trade deal after trade deal after trade deal as soon as the BBB passed. That was the plan the whole time. Well, here they come. And that's going to lead to a new conspiracy theory. That's how conspiracy got in the title today. It is not a bit of clickbait at all. There is a conspiracy that is going to come out of this. It hasn't started yet. I guarantee you within like one or two more great trade deals, which are going to come, the conspiracy special people are going to start. And I'll tell you what it's going to be. And I made a post this morning on Facebook and X saying it was going to happen. And I said, when it does happen and somebody tells them, look, hey, this guy here said you guys were going to say this shit before it started, they'll say, oh, he's in on it. He's a paid shill. Watch and see if that doesn't happen, too. So that should be fun. Tesla and Samsung are about to do a massive deal, just as I said was always the plan. And the key is Austin and them being so close to each other. I mean, it's a cheap Uber ride between the two buildings. This had to happen. It had to be part of the plan all along, because Tesla needs chips. And guess what Samsung does? Guess what else Samsung's going to need in the future? Batteries. Just saying. Anyway, Bitcoin price action is about to really heat up. We're about to go really heavy in the upward direction. Lots of volatility, lots of this, but this. Through the end of the year, at least, I'll tell you why. Duke University. Well, you know, they're not laying people off. They're having early retirements. Yeah, I have an actual internal memo leaked to me by a friend. We'll leave it at that. Of what's going on at Duke University, and it's everything that I have foreseen is coming to pass, just like Emperor Palpatine. Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen. And then I'm going to give you 10 top trade jobs and median salaries at 5 years for young people to look at other than college, because as we're going to find out today, college is in fact collapsing, and we just don't need as many degree people as we have. I was going to say degree professionals, but they're not professionals, just people with degrees. to be a professional, you have to be good at what you do and get paid for it. And let's be honest, most people with degrees don't do what their degree is supposedly prepared them to do. We've seen a lot of that lately, and it's only going to get worse. And we talk about trade jobs all the time. I thought it might be a good idea. So I've got a list here and all my stuff. I feel like an old school newscaster. I got a stack of paperwork today. That are the actual trades, the very base level of how a young person can look into and get into and what it takes to become a professional in that space. And then at 5 years of work, because I think what you make in your first year, especially in an apprentice program where you're being trained and paid at the same time, it's irrelevant to what the career value is, right? You can go to college for 4 years and rack up debt, or you can go to a trade apprentice program for 5 years. And, you know, long before your fifth year, you're already making much better money. But the fact that you might get paid fairly low, maybe a little bit better than somebody working at a fast food place while you're learning a trade and getting overtime, well, that kind of balances out. And by the way, the median salaries I have, these are based on 40-hour work weeks, and they're really impressive. And a lot of these trades, if you want overtime, as long as you're in a place that has the ability, you can get it. In fact, it will benefit you to take it, because then you're seen as a hard worker. And these are jobs that people are actually supposed to work at. I know that's a novel idea. These are not jobs that you spend a lot of time at the coffee maker talking about the football game over the weekend, right? That's not how these jobs work. These are real work in men's jobs for people that actually work. All right, with that, before we get into it, let's go ahead here from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is BuildTongUSA.com. That's Anton, and he is an awesome dude. He's been on the show. He hangs out in the live feed quite often. Really good dude. He came here to the United States, legally I might add, from South Africa, and he makes real South African biltong. He also makes real South African druwors, which are a dry sausage. It's kind of like a biltong sausage. And he makes some Kalabanasi sausage that is out of this freaking world. He has a lot of other really cool stuff. When you're on his site, you might want to check out some of the things, like some of the spices and seasonings he's got too. I mean, this guy imports from all over the world, some really, really cool stuff. One of my favorite things he sent me, for instance, is a smoked salt, a Chihuahuan smoked salt from Mexico. It is freaking the bomb, guys. Check out BuildTongUSA.com and, you know, poke around and see all of the stuff that you can get from Anton. Next up today, Jeff, the Berkey Guy Gleason at USABerkeyFilters.com. Look, guys, you want to make sure you're drinking clean, pure, good quality water. You want to make sure you can keep doing that even if things go wrong, like when they tell you to boil your water and something already went wrong. That's why they're telling you to boil your water. And you want to do it in a way that is cost effective. Berkeys are not cheap, but you know how we feel about cheap around here. The word cheap is a profane word. I'd rather you say shit or ass than cheap. Cheap is a bad, bad, bad word. So we don't want cheap. What we want is cost effective. What we want is to be frugal. What we want is the lowest cost per gallon of high quality water produced out of a system. And Berkey beats everybody on that. Everybody. And it's, you know, just dead strong, proven technology, works perfectly, and it looks beautiful. No moving parts. There's nothing to break, which means you can always service it yourself. It's pretty much, you don't even need tools. Finger tighten, little washer to seal, replace the filters every once in a while or wash them out. That's it. It's easy. Anybody can do it, even me. Check it out today at USABerkeyFilters.com. Remember, USA Berkey Filters and Anton's Lane, or I'm sorry, Biltong USA. Both of those are partners of the MSB as well that offer you discounts on the MSB. On that, before we get into the show, the Members Brigade is on sale, guys. $35 a year to become a member of the supporting Members Brigade for the show. I launched this program in 2010. Okay, no, 2009. February 2009, I launched this program. I checked today. Do you know I have members who have been members since the month I launched this program and have not left? They've stayed in a recurring membership from 2009 to 2025. And I'll tell you why. Because it saves you money. It does not cost anything to be a member of the MSB if you use the discounts. It costs $0. It's free. It's profitable. And it's really profitable when you can get it for $35 versus $50 a year. How do you do that? Just use discount code SUMMER when you sign up. That sale ends at the end of this week. right? And I don't care if your dog eats your discount code. When it's over, it is over. So get on it while you can. All right, with that, let's dig into this. Let's start off with the EU deal. Now, whenever I say Trump did something good or Trump came out on top in a negotiation, which is really what I'm saying here, the second one, then everybody thinks I'm carrying orange water. I'm not. I don't give a shit about any of these people. I really, especially if you're new to this show, it's really important to me that you understand that my analysis of what somebody sitting in the White House is doing is independent of my feelings for them personally. I don't care about them at all. I don't trust them at all. I think they're all liars. And I think anybody to rise to that level has to have some percentage of them that is kind of scummy. I'm sorry. It's just a dirty ass game. I'll also tell you, like, people will be really shocked to hear this, but you have to temper it with what I just said. In my adult life, probably the best president we've ever had, if you take away his loony sayings that only focused on his policies, is Donald Trump. He's Donald Trump. And I know the economy's fake and whatever, but that's what he has to work with, guys. Okay? Now, this deal with the EU, this was the impossible deal. This is the, it's going to destroy everything, as though we buy that much from Europe anyway. You know, it's going to destroy inflation. 30% tariffs. Oh, my God. Right? So the 30% tariff was basically the stick. And the 15% tariff was the carrot. You guys can't handle the 30. You can handle the 15. I can do either one. Give me what I want, and I'll give you the 15. And people went, oh, he's crazy. It's Canada being the 51st state all over again and taking over Greenland, which, by the way, he finally shut up about that. That's great. So the EU just basically said, sure, you're okay, Karen. Ursula von der Leyen, right? She just basically said, okay, sure. Now, they didn't immediately say, okay, sure. Apparently, it was a very brutal pre-negotiation. You have to understand that when Orange Man and Ursula come together, right, the deal's 90% there. It's a closing situation at that point. Most of it has already been hashed out. And maybe you're like, okay, we're almost there, but they still want this and we still want that. And then you send in the big guns, your closers, to end the thing. Well, that just, like I said, it's like he threw her over his lap and just spanked her ass until she gave in, right? She gave up everything. 15% tariff on most EU goods entering the U.S., now from a threatened 30%. And a shitload of U.S. stuff into Europe with zero tariff at all. I think the EU screwed the pooch in this one. Certain sectors, now this is coming back in our country, like aircraft parts, some chemicals, semiconductors, and agricultural products will have zero tariffs under the agreement. Here's something nobody's telling you. What we're going to cover later, like the new giant Samsung factory and some of the other factories being built in the United States to make chips and semiconductors here again, we're not going to need that much of it, but we need it for now. So that's why there was a carve-out for it. The EU committed to purchasing approximately $750 billion in U.S. energy and semiconductor products over 3 years. So we're not tariffing them to bring semiconductors into our country. They can bring those in free, but they're agreeing to buy ours going out because the entire market for semiconductors is shifting, and they're at like the current generation, and what we're going to be producing very soon is the next generation, and they're not able to get there yet. So you see, that's a very much a snooker right there, if you're familiar with the billiards game called snooker. And then they also agreed to invest $600 billion in the U.S., including military equipment and infrastructure. Now, that sounds like we're selling them arms. Well, we're doing that, but that's a different deal. It has nothing to do with this. This is arms manufacturers, weapons manufacturers in like Germany or France are agreeing now to come to the United States and do their manufacturing, production, and development here, hiring U.S. workers. So just, you know, think of it like Siemens is a German company, but the biggest Siemens factory in the world is in Texas. So it's kind of that all over again. 600 billion. So that's 1.35 trillion over the next 3 years of EU spending in the United States. And they agreed to all of this. The 50% U.S. tariff on steel remains in place, though there's probably a quota system coming soon. In other words, Right now, all steel coming into the United States from the EU has a 50% tariff, but it looks like they left room to negotiate in the future to say, well, you can bring in this much on a lower tariff, and then it goes up to the top rate. So that's like a little bit of a concession from us, but we didn't actually do it yet. The EU has reacted with mixed views. Germany and Italy are like, that's fine, right? That's fine. It's 15%. It's not that big of a freaking deal. And now we know we have a see, this is the thing people understand about markets. Markets don't really care there's a 15% tariff. Markets care they don't know what it's going to be. Markets do not like unpredictable situations, okay? Markets don't like it's 15% now, it could be 30% tomorrow, it could be 50% the next day, and then it could be zero. And then it could be 100%, and then it could be 5. Like, they don't want that. So they have certainty and security now. The only people bitching about it is France. Well, France says it's legally vague and unbalanced. I think legally vague and unbalanced would be Justin Trudeau, not Justin Trudeau, what's his name? Marcon. Right, Marcon is unbalanced and vague, as is the gender of his wife. Right, but France is probably pissed off because France actually, believe it or not, makes quite a bit of steel that they sell into the United States, and that's the one that still has the big nasty tariff on it. Pharmaceuticals and semiconductor imports from the EU will face zero tariffs temporarily, with a guarantee that any future tariffs after U.S. Investigations conclude will not exceed 15%. So basically we said, hey, look, we'll let you bring in pharmaceuticals and semiconductors for no tariff whatsoever. We're not really sure of what the impact is yet, and we may impose a tariff on the future, and you have to be okay with that. And as long as you are, we'll let the skill go now, and we'll cap that. We'll say whatever it is, it will not be higher than 15%. Again, markets can work with this. Markets know, okay, the certainty is not whether or not there's going to be a tariff or how high it's going to be. The certainty is it will not exceed 15%. So financial models can be built with a number that's a hard cap. And as long, you see, the only people that don't understand this are people that never ran businesses before. You need me to build a business plan for a business and tell you if it works or not. All I need are some concrete numbers to work with, right? I need to know my cost basis. I need to know my production cost. I need to know what my projected ARPU is going to be. I need to be able to project my COGS and my ARPU, and then I can factor in what my profit looks like and if it makes sense. Okay? COGS is cost of goods sold, and then ARPU is average revenue per unit or per user, depending on what you're talking about. If I have those, I'm good. So the markets are happy with this. But this is a beating. And I'll tell you how you know it's a beating. The liberal rags that generally, if Donald Trump cured cancer personally, would say he's putting you know, researchers out of work. He's putting doctors out of work, right? Those people. What they're saying is the deal's unfair to Europe. I thought you wanted America to win. I thought as much as you hated Trump and MAGA and all that, I thought you guys always kind of defaulted to, but yeah, we do want good things for America. In other words, the deal is too good for us. That's their complaint in it. That tells you everything you need to know. This was an absolute beatdown. And the thing is, the EU is one of the biggest financial blocks in the world. And once the EU accepts a beatdown, everybody else is going to accept a beatdown. And if you beat down enough of them, you can go deal very, very harshly with China. And you can tell China, if you don't do the deal, we don't need you. You need us. And once you've broken off everybody else from China in that agreement, and basically we've done that with India too, so that India would be the other, you know, billion-plus population nation that has semi-decent trade. Like, India and China have a narrow band where they share a border, and they fucking hate each other in that spot. And everywhere else, they just kind of get along. They're kind of okay, like, trade-wise. They're in good shape with each other. But India knows where its naan is buttered. And it ain't China, it's the United States. So once you break off India in the EU, everybody else is just going to come in and kiss the ring. And that's why the left is losing their mind about this. And we took advantage of Europe. And my response is, the rest of the world has taken advantage of us for so long, I don't give a shit. And I want the best deal for America, honestly. I get that. So this was a good deal for us overall. Now, I know I'm going to have the special people, the special libertarians. Jack, you're supposed to be an anarchist. You're not supposed to want taxes at all. I don't. If I was in charge, but here's the key, I'm not. But if I was, there'd be no taxes on anything. I would get rid of all taxes, period, the end. But this is not reality. The anarchist view is aspirational. When you look at what's going on around you, you need to look at it the way that it is and the way that it's going to be so that you know how to react to it. This is going to be gas on the markets. They're going to take off like fire from all of this. The tax cuts, the incentives, the deals, all of it. And the deals are going to rain down like money in a strip joint now. About 1 week for most of the rest of the year, if not all the way to the end of the year. To the point that Trump is actually a really good marketer. Now, again, this isn't me kissing his orange ass or anything. He's a good marketer. That's how he made his name worth so much effing money. And the way you make this really go well is you don't come out in one day and say, we made deals with these 10 countries. You announce a deal a week. We just made a deal with, you know, Singapore. We just made a deal with Malaysia. We just made a deal with Australia. We just made a deal with Japan. Like, that's how you roll those out to the point where even you make a deal with somebody, you say, hey, we need you to do one more thing in this deal. Shh, be quiet. We're going to announce it next week because, you know, Chile is going before you, Brazil. Well, why? Well, because they made the deal first. And we want you to have, here's how you present it to your adversary and make them feel good about it. We want you to have 100% mind share. If we release this information this week, you have to share it with another country. If we wait till next week, it's all about you. Don't you want it to be all about you? That's the conversation. How do I know that? Because that's what I would do. You put me back in my role as a sales negotiator. It's exactly what I would do in that negotiation type of situation. Be a different thing, but the same. The same, but different, man. All right. Now, all of this is going to happen, and the economic implications of the markets are going to erupt. Everything's going to look good for Team Orange. Whether you like it or not doesn't matter. It's going to. And in the end, even if you're like, I hate that son of a bitch, when they have more money, when all the economic indicators are blinking green, when they feel better, then they like Orange Man even if they say they don't. And you can look at past elections to see this. When you have a good economy and an incumbent president running for re-election, they vote like crazy for the incumbent president, even people who say they're not going to. It happened for Obama. By his second term, the economy had completely turned around from the bust of 2008. It wasn't roaring, but it was much better than it was. So the comparative model, and he destroyed in that re-election bid. I mean, absolutely just beat the shit out of, I don't remember if it was Romney or McCain, which order that went in. It doesn't matter, right? But yeah, that's what happened. So what's going to happen when all this good comes, right? Especially from the people who are more like right-leaning libertarians, but they really hate Trump. That is the mother asshole of conspiracy, okay? It births all the new crazy conspiracies because I think, to be fair, I think we need new crazy conspiracies because all the old conspiracies have been proven true now, right? So now the conspiracy people are like, we don't have anything to do. We got to come up with some. So here's the conspiracy, folks, right? And this has nothing to do with my thoughts about Trump and Epstein directly, whether he's on the list or not. It doesn't matter. This is the conspiracy theory that's going to come out of it. The only reason that Orange Man's getting all these countries to do these deals is all the world's foreign leaders are on the list, and they know he can let the list out, and he's holding it over their head, and he's saying, if you don't give me the deal, maybe someone will find out that, you know, you are hugely involved in it. Like, that's the next conspiracy theory. I bet you money that will happen. Anybody wants a $100 bet that by the end of September, that conspiracy theory will be floating around. First person to email me and take it. I'll make a $100 bet with you. Go ahead. Email me now. TSPC bet in the subject line. What I'm saying is you will be able to easily find a circulating conspiracy theory that Trump is holding the Epstein list over the heads of foreign leaders, and that's how he's getting the success he's getting by the end of September. Anybody wants the bet? I sit here and I await your email. All right, moving on. Tesla and Samsung. This is one that, you know, all you have to know is some basic information. And I'm going to tell you that my information is a little more than basic on this one because I have a good friend who is directly involved, or at least was directly involved with some of this. But I think I could have made this connection myself had that not been the case. And if you guys remember, and this is under a paywall, so I didn't realize that when I selected this source. I'll find a different one and add it to the show notes for you so you don't have to deal with a paywall. It's Bloomberg, so I know I'll be able to get around it with archive.org. So I'll put up the archive link. But you still see the headline, Samsung to make Tesla AI chips in multi-year Texas deal. So the last episode we did, I had John and Nicole on for our first Tuesday coffee chat, I said this would happen. And this is what I said. I said, you can't have the largest production factory ever built in the United States at the time it was built in the Texas Gigafactory. And then Samsung comes in and builds the new largest facility in the whole country ever been built, under roof, more acres under roof than any facility ever, the Samsung facility being built by South Korea. Like, it's literally just down the road and around the corner from a Tesla factory. I said, you can't have that happen by coincidence. Austin's not a bad place to build something like that, but it's not the only place. There's a lot of places you could have done it. There had to be some sort of back end between Tesla and Samsung already going on. So this new deal is that Samsung is going to be making and building chips for Tesla. They're going to be used for AI systems, which probably means they're going to tie into like the whole Grok thing, but also into the self-driving technology of Tesla vehicles and the Tesla robots and shit too. Now, here's the other thing, right? This hasn't been announced yet, but I'm telling you this is going to come. These types of deals, when you're talking about, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations and these facilities being this close to each other, these deals are done backdoor. And Samsung is going to have a great need for batteries. And Tesla, above all things, I have a very good friend who's part of how I know this. He likes to refer to Tesla not as a car company, but as a technology company. And I think he's right. So don't think I'm really like pushing back too much on my buddy here. But when I think of the actual product, right, Tesla builds technology into their products and sells a product. But what is their main product to the world, not just to the person buying a Tesla vehicle? It's batteries. It's batteries. Tesla is building factories to become the largest producer of the best batteries in the world because their ultimate goal is to sell their batteries to their competitors. And they're going to do it because they're doing it better than anybody else. So not only do they want to sell to their competitors like the electronic Chevy or the Chevy EV or whatever, they also want to sell those batteries to anybody and everybody that is in the business that needs batteries. Well, Samsung is in a business that needs batteries because Samsung is also deeply involved with solar. That's something a lot of people aren't aware of. So there is going to be a litany of deals made between Tesla and Samsung going forward. And the proximity of the two factories, these two huge, and I don't think you can, to use a term on purpose, you know, grok the size of these facilities if you haven't seen them. So I haven't been by the Samsung facility. I haven't been down there on that side of things since the Samsung facility started really being built. But after completion, I've driven right past the Tesla facility. There's a warehouse, like a logistics warehouse about 6 miles south of my house, maybe 10 miles south of my house. As they were building it, everybody on next door around here said it has to be an Amazon center. It has to be an Amazon center just because of the size. And this building is flipping huge. It's not an Amazon center. I can't remember the name of the company, but they're a logistics company. Basically, they're a warehouse for warehouses. So there's plenty of Amazon shit in there. Because like I never thought it was going to be Amazon because it's an Amazon, huge Amazon warehouse just about 15 miles to the east of that one. But there's Amazon shit in there. So basically, like the warehouse is warehousing stuff for the other warehouses. So Walmart's crap is in there. Amazon's crap is in there. Stuff like that. That building is massive. You look at the building, you go, oh my God, how it looks like a piss ant structure compared to the Gigafactory. The productivity capacity of that facility, they're not even scratching the surface on what it's eventually going to be yet. Now, how do I know about so much about the Tesla and the Samsung facility? So one of my best friends was basically the project manager for the construction of the Gigafactory, and for a time was running the project for building the Samsung factory. So he was running both of them. He completed the Tesla one, and he eventually decided, I don't want to do this anymore, and left the Samsung gig in spite of it paying really, really, really well. So I have a little more information than I guess maybe others might in this. Let's move on from there, though. Let's talk about Bitcoin price action and what's really coming. We're about to have like a 4-month period, 3 to 4 month period of Bitcoin just like going higher and higher and higher and higher. And I don't completely agree with some of my sources who are telling me like you might see $10,000 a day. I think you might see some days with $10,000. And I think you might go a period of time where aggregating it out, it might be that big, some really big ones and some smaller. And you'll have some downs in it. But what you're going to have is continuous upward price reflected for at least a quarter. I mean, here's a couple reasons. Number one, we're in that time. Just a normal cycle, if everything was equal, and it's not, it's all to the better. But if everything was equal, there's a reason that they call October in the post-halving year, meaning Bitcoin's halving happened last year, the October of the post-halving year, this year, they call it Uptober. Uptober. There's a reason for that, because historically, that cycle hits, okay? That's one thing. But there's another thing. I have some links that you can look at in the show notes if you want to today. One is to a video that was just dropped today by Swan Bitcoin. And what they're talking about in it is something that was talked about and discussed in great detail on X for different reasons, a $9 billion single trade. Right now, you know that a lot of the buys that companies like Strategy do, right, they're direct purchases. They don't go across the exchange. A seller and a buyer kind of find each other through an exchange, but they don't, you know, Michael Saylor doesn't go to, you know, Gemini or Coinbase and put in an order to buy, you know, 10,000 Bitcoin. That's not how that works. Well, this trade was pretty much done that way. Like, this dude dropped $9 billion worth of Bitcoin on an exchange. I don't think it was Gemini now. I'm not sure who it was. Let's just pretend it was Gemini, but I think it was a different exchange. And like sold $8 billion worth of Bitcoin in one trade. $8 billion. Now, there was a time not so long ago that if one seller came in and dropped $8 billion worth of Bitcoin, the price plummeted. The price went down about $5,000, but it was at 120. And it immediately started to rebound. You know what that tells you? Yeah, 80,000 Bitcoin. Mike's right. It's 80,000 Bitcoin. It was about $8 billion. And it did no net effect on the price. Yeah, you just said it went down $5,000 from 120 to 115 and change up, right? Like, that's 2%, 2.5%, 3%. That's meaningless. And it was over a weekend. And where are we at right now? Let's just check so I'm not making shit up and lying to you or whatever. I think we're at like 118 right now. Yeah, 118. So, like, if Bitcoin would have moved over the weekend from 120 to 115 to 118 today, and that hadn't happened, no one would have said anything. That would have been normal price action. It happens all the time. So that $9 billion or $8 billion trade, because they didn't sell quite all of it. It was like they sold 70,000 Bitcoin of the 80,000 they transferred, right? Did nothing to the price. And this is something that people that keep wanting to push up shitcoins and saying, oh, man, it's going to be Ripple. No, man, it's going to be Solana. No, man, it's going to be shitcoin XYZ PDQ or whatever else they come up with, right? No, it's not. Because these other currencies, right, I'll use that term loosely, do not have what's known as depth of liquidity into the dollar. So if you look at it, for instance, the average trading volume of Bitcoin exceeds just about everything else. Just about everything, by a long shot. What it doesn't exceed the trading volume of would be things like Tether. And that's because Tether is used in all the in and out trades. If you sell your poop coin or your pee coin or your fart coin or your Bitcoin or your Ether or your Sol, and you want to go into dollars as a trader and hold for the next buy, you go in and out of stable. So they're irrelevant, okay? That's the dollar. We already know the dollar has liquidity. It's the dollar is what we want liquidity into, so it's not a problem. Ethereum will have, now some days it actually has a really high volume and Bitcoin is relatively low, but in general, Ethereum's average trading volume is roughly half that of Bitcoin. Average trading volume for Ripple, the number three crypto in the world, right? The one that the banks are using, man, is about $6 billion. And that's all the in and out bullshit too, right? That's not enough depth of liquidity for nations to invest in. That is not enough depth of liquidity for a company like Tesla or Strategy or any of these corporations that are now putting Bitcoin on. There's not enough depth of liquidity there. What I mean by that is when you put something on a balance sheet in a company, if you need the cash, you need to know you can get the cash. You need to know the depth of liquidity is there. There's nothing else that has it except stable coins, and they don't matter because they don't have any of the upside potential at all. You might as well just hold dollars. So it's the only thing that has that depth of liquidity. Now you also have some other things going on in here that's going to support the price way more than in the past. The ETFs, but not the way that you think. Not just that they're there. It's what they're accounting for in acquisition daily. Their daily acquisition is pretty much 100% of all the natural Bitcoin. What do I mean by natural Bitcoin? I mean when the miners go brrrr and they make new Bitcoin, there's a certain amount of block reward. Pretty much 100% of what the miners produce is being bought by the combined 11 ETFs. It's like if you took the ETFs out and what they locked up out, there is no new supply just from that. However, when you also look at all the Bitcoin treasuries, like Strategy B and all these companies, little ones and big ones alike, they combined are also buying up all the newly minted Bitcoin. So you have two separate entities, I guess you would say, or groups of entities that are purchasing all the new Bitcoin times two when you put them together. That means all the regular trading that's left out there is just what's already here. You know, we make a big deal out of the halving. The halving's become less and less significant to the supply at hand. As the supply at hand grows, the halving has less of an effect on the growth. There's not really any left, is the best way to look. Over 90% has been mined. It's 100 years plus to mine the rest of it. There's no way you're going to see a correction now typical of the past. I didn't say there's no way you would see a correction. I didn't say you might not see a 50% drawdown at some point once we have the blow off top, whenever we have that. Now, some very switched on people, I'm not sold on this yet, but they may be, I'm like 80% there with them, but I'm not ready to call it myself yet. There's some very switched on people with very good track records over the years. And I'm not talking people that go back 5 years to 2020 when Michael Orange got in, right? I'm talking about going all the way back to like when I was getting in, right? Like 2012. There are people from those worlds saying our blow off top in this cycle isn't even in this cycle. It's in 2027. Now, if that happens, I'll be amazed myself. If that happens, you're looking at $1 million before 2030. But whatever is going to happen, it's about to go parabolic. Do with that information as you choose. Remember, I don't give financial advice. I just call balls and strikes. And that's what I see going on here. Next, I want to talk to you guys about something from the past, a little bit of history lesson for you guys today. As you guys know, I'm a big reader, including audiobooks, so I consider all of it reading because it's going into the mind of an author. And I have deeply read books like Broken Money by Lynn Alden, The Fiat Standard by Seyfi Namos, The Bitcoin Standard by Seyfi Namos. I'm trying to think of the one by Lawrence Leopard that I'm reading now, The Big Print, right? I'll read all these books. And as I'm reading them, a name keeps popping up. Some gloss over it, some dig a little bit deeper into it. But it's a name that I think of all U.S. presidents is underrated for how much damage he did to the country. He should be one of the most detested, hated presidents that ever served in the office. He's dead now, so that might help you narrow down who it is. But right now, if I say who's responsible for destroying the United States dollar, there's some dates that are going to pop up in your head. You're going to think the 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve, and you're going to think about, you know, Woodrow Wilson, who deserves a list at the top of despised presidents, no doubt. You're going to think, who are you going to think next? FDR, right? Took the nation's gold, revalued the dollar against it. Yeah. Okay. You got those two. Now, who are you going to think of next? What name's going to come up next in your mind? Richard Milhouse Nixon. That evil bastard closed the gold window. But Nixon didn't fucking do it. Nixon was like the doctor that walked in after other doctors had taken care of a patient and went, yeah, he's fucking dead. Time of death, 12:02 p.m. Nixon didn't do it. Fucking Johnson did it. I'm about to lay out a case for you here. I brought the receipts. Okay? So everyone blames Nixon in 71, but LBJ set the stage and pulled the trigger years earlier. So after World War II, the dollar was still tied to gold under the Bretton Woods system, right? And foreign governments could still trade dollars for U.S. gold under that system. And since the United States gold, the United States had like more gold than any five other countries put together, it made a really good case that, you know, since we won the war, since we have the atomic bomb, since we're defending everybody, since we're rebuilding everything, we should have the pleasure of being the world's currency. And all the other currencies looked at it and said, or all the other countries looked at it and said, yeah, maybe. And this was our solution. We'll hold the gold. We'll do all global transactions, international transactions in the U.S. dollar. And everybody's money will be pegged to the dollar at a fixed rate. You know, 1.5 to 1, you know, 0.5 to 1. Like the great British pound was always stronger than the dollar. Right. And like the franc was weaker than the dollar, and it was by design, and it was a peg, a straight peg. In other words, you could always calculate how many francs you got for a dollar, or how many great British pounds you got for a dollar. You got it? It was pegged. And then again, the foreign governments, since they were selling shit to the United States, we would buy their imports with dollars, and we agreed to buy a lot of their shit to help them get their economies back on track, because ours was great. We were in an incredible boom of the post-World War II economy, so we'll buy your stuff. Hey, we make plenty of stuff. We ship plenty of stuff out. We'll buy your stuff. So they kept getting dollars, and we kept getting stuff. Eventually, you know, I got all these dollars. What am I going to do with them? Well, I can exchange them for gold. Well, how does this work out? What LBJ did then is in 68, he signed a law that ended the requirement for dollars to be backed by gold. Did you know that? Nixon closed the window, but it wasn't Nixon that stopped the link between dollars and gold. It wasn't Nixon that removed the peg. Johnson did it in 68, right? Up until then, the Fed had to hold gold at equal to 25% of the money it printed. So we had to hold a 25% reserve against the M3 dollar supply in the world. It was Johnson who removed that, who said, no, we don't. Okay, now, I want you to think about something. You're France. You got all these dollars, all this shit paper, all these greenbacks, right? And then you're like, what? So basically, the person that you can exchange the dollars back to gold with says, yeah, we're not holding a reserve at a fixed rate anymore. What are you going to give me my fucking gold? That's exactly what happened. Once that was gone, nothing was holding the dollar to gold anymore. So when you think that the dollar's gold backing ended in 71, it did. It ended in 68. We ended the gold back, but we didn't end the redemption. So we went from like 600, 660,000 tons. It was 600 or 60,000 something tons of gold to about 300,000. Our gold reserves between 68 and 71 were cut by 50% roughly. Now, once that was gone, nothing holding it to gold anymore. And then on top of it, LBJ decided to do what? He inherited this minor conflict in a place called Vietnam after Kennedy got his cap blown. And instead of keeping it minor or getting out of it, he escalated it. And he escalated it so much, and he was so tied in with scum that he literally told a person, I can't remember who, John something, I think that was a general, I can't end Vietnam. I have friends that are making too much money off of it. Now, where did that money come from? It's not like we were raiding Vietnam for its wealth and bringing it like old days, like the hordes, right? Like, that just was government spending for munitions to keep the war going. So basically, Johnson said, we're robbing the taxpayers and enriching my friends. I can't stop that. Bro literally said that. That's on the record. So he needed money for Vietnam, but he also needed money for the Great Society, because that was his other thing. Like, he was the new two chickens in every pot and two cars in every driveway, right? Like, that was the Great Society. We have guns and butter. We can have both. It'll be great. I just discovered this new way to print money. So he did that. So again, all these other countries started demanding gold for their dollars. Now, this was led by France, but they weren't the only one. Gold supply went down by 50%, our reserves, because since we were still doing it, I mean, they were literally like, France sent ships to the United States. Give us our fucking gold. We're taking it back to France. All right? So then the London gold pool collapsed. The whole system was under stress. Foreign leaders knew the U.S. could not hold the peg much longer, so they too were like, we want our gold. So Nixon comes in 1971. He looks at this and goes, if we let this go any further, we will have zero gold. All you have to do is the math. How many dollars are out there? How much gold is in here? It's not going to work. Now, what Nixon could have done, though it would have been more complex to do it, is he could have revalued gold. He could have revalued gold like FDR did. He could have said, One ounce of gold is now 100 U.S. dollars, which sounds like really cheap, doesn't it? Yeah, it wasn't at the time. It was like $33 and something cents to the ounce. So he could have done that. That would have immediately just walloped the United States with inflation. But there it is right there. Thank you for putting that. John Dowie, man. How could I not remember that name, right? We have our own John Dowie, right? I cannot get out of Vietnam, John. My friends are making too much money. Lyndon Johnson to Colonel John Dowie in 1966. In fact, CJ, Professor CJ, posted that on X this weekend, and that's what made me put this segment in the show. When I saw that, I'm like, I forgot all about that one. We need to talk about that, right? So when Nixon closes the window, there's only two choices. Close the exchange window or rebase the dollar to gold value. Now, you're a president. You're coming into a weak economy that's getting worse. Do you want to be the president that caused a 66% inflation overnight? Because that's what that revaluing would have done. Now, I think long term, we would have been better for it. But no president who wants to get reelected, and at the time, that was still a possibility, right? In fact, he did get reelected, didn't he? And then the whole Watergate thing happened, right? Yeah. So there was nothing to be done other than one of those two choices. Now, which one would you have done if you're president, not if you're trying to be right? You're trying to govern and you don't want to lose power. Well, you know what you would do, okay? So that was the final step. The system was already broken. By the time Nixon acted, LBJ had already dismantled the backing. It was already gone. And the other thing you have to look at is the spending. The spending that happened after 1968 up until Nixon came in was god-awful ridiculous. If you look at the total numbers today, they don't sound big. But if you look at them relative to GDP, they were just huge while we were transitioning from a gold-backed, partial gold-backed system to a fiat system. Like, it's a train wreck. Nixon made the announcement, but LBJ made it inevitable. Like I said, to me, Nixon was just a doctor that called the time of death. That's what happened. Now you know something. 229 Mick says, wow, imagine if we only had a 60% inflation since 1968. That is an interesting way to look at it, isn't it? That is an interesting way to look at it. Now, I don't think we would have only had a 60% inflation rate. But if we would have had like a 0.5% a year after the 60%, we would still be miles ahead of where we are today. But that was never going to happen. Mr. G. McConey says, save yourself, buy Bitcoin. I agree. So now I want to talk to you about the college enrollment cliff. I'm going to do something I almost never do. I do have my stack of news anchor papers today, but usually I don't read. I have, you know, if you look, I just have bullet points. Like, I guess you can't see that, but just bullet points is what I have for my presentations. In this one here, though, I actually have a letter, and I want to read it because I think this is an interesting look at the reality of what's going on. So it was about the time that COVID really picked up that I said, we are about to watch the dismantling of the United States education system as we know it. We are going to have this massive fall off in enrollments in the college, and you're going to see major universities either closing the doors or reducing the size of campuses, closing down remote campuses, satellite campuses, entire buildings, et cetera, laying off professors. And what did everybody say? Yeah, no shit, Jack. That system is all propped up. It'll never go away. That's not going to happen. I'm like, hey, look, guys, even the colleges are saying there's an enrollment cliff coming, meaning there's just less kids coming out of high school. And we're going to get to a point where the number of kids coming out of high school, if all of them went to college, it's not enough to make up for past enrollments. You don't know anything. They're not going anywhere. Okay. All right. This is Duke University. Okay, so this is like the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre Community College here, right? Is there anybody out there going to tell me Duke University doesn't fit the type of institution that I was talking about when I said big mainstream institutions? I mean, I think Duke qualifies, right? Okay, this is an internal email that comes from an unnamed source inside Duke University. Dear Duke community, we are writing to update you on the outcome of the Staff Voluntary Separation Initiative Program, VSIP, which was offered this spring, and on our next steps in the university's strategic realignment and cost reduction program. Anybody that's ever worked for a corporation that was in a bad way has read something like this, and you know what it really means. It means no matter what they're telling you, under the hood, it's worse than it looks from outside, okay? It'll keep going. As you know, Duke, like many universities across the country, it's not just us. Yeah, we know that. Anyway, faces actual and potential federal funding reductions in support of our research, teaching, and clinical missions. It's Orange Man's fault. That's the translation there, okay? These include dramatically lower research support and increased tax rates on our endowment. In other words, we now have to pay money on all the tax-free money that we're making off the money that was donated to our university that we're supposed to use for our university, but all we do is siphon the interest off of it. Yeah, that's why they've built $1 billion allotments, okay? Okay. We're also seeing tightened visa restrictions on our international students. Then why are you turning down American students? Why do we have students who mostly are like white males with like massive high-tech scores, 4.0 GPAs, that are not getting accepted to these top universities when they apply? Why? It's just we can't get enough people from India to keep the lights on. That's what this says. Bullshit. We have pledged to keep you informed as we navigate this complex language. The corporate speak in this is freaking astounding to me. I've been through corporate mergers. I've read this shit in my past. Oh, my God. Seeking to protect our most vital asset, Duke's faculty, staff, trainees, and students. Get the fuck out of here. No, your most valuable asset is real estate and money, and you are bleeding both of them. I'm sorry. To the greatest extent possible, before the VSIP was enacted, you know, they always had to make fucking acronyms for everything. We froze most staff and faculty hiring. So that's what every corporate entity does when they know they're going to have to lay people off, is they send a signal, please go away, by freezing hiring. When you hear a hiring freeze, that is never a good indicator of the future. We limited non-essential spending and directed units across Duke to refocus. It's every corporate bullshit word when you're fucked in one letter. To refocus on improving efficiency across their operations. Additionally, more than 250 eligible faculty members across the university are currently considering voluntary retirement incentive offers. Right? In other words, they're considering leaving, taking some money as an early retirement, which is nowhere near what a retirement would be, and going away to do something else, except most of them have no other place to go. I'm just saying. With the VSET process complete, we wanted to let you know that 599 staff accepted the university's offer through this program. We are sad to see these valued colleagues and members of our community leave Duke, and we thank them for their many contributions and dedicated services. Some Karen wrote that one. That's an HR Karen writing. So basically, 599 accepted it. 250 are eligible and still considering it. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. Even with these cost reduction measures in place and a high rate of VSIP acceptance, we will unfortunately need to further reduce university workforce to ensure we can responsibly support and invest in our important missions. What does that mean? If you're one of these people that's eligible and considering it, you might want to take it, because the fact that you're eligible tells you you're on the block. See, basically, this is a force out letter. This is, you better take the money or you're going to get nothing. That's what this is. With the results of the VSIP now known, we have asked all schools and units to release their budgets and identify further non-personnel expense reductions that can be made. These assessments will determine the scale of involuntary staff reductions, which will take place in August. You got a month, bitches, and you're going to get fired. You better take your money and get on out of here, right? For those staff who are funded by research grants, reductions in our force occur regularly through the year based on available research funding. We determined that an involuntary reduction in force is necessary only after careful consideration and extensive consultation with leadership across Duke. Note, the high number of VSIP and participants means fewer employees will be affected by this action, but not none. Okay? The news weighs heavily on all of us at Duke. I promise you, the fucking people that wrote this shit, they're not laying themselves off. This is crazy, right? And we want to be direct about the next phase of this process. Between August 5th and August 19th, impacted employees will be contacted individually by their managers, and we'll work closely with Human Resource Karen through, it doesn't say Karen, but I had to put that in there. We'll work closely with the Human Resources Karens through this transition. We recognize and are sorry for the impact these changes will have on our colleagues. Get out, assholes. That's what that means. We continue to ask that everyone respect the privacy of each community member as this process moves forward. Don't tell anybody how much money you got, or you won't get any. Keep your mouth shut about the deal we make with you, and do not ask anybody about the deal we made with them. That's what that says. While the challenges before us are difficult, we're confident we can navigate them as a community and maintain our exceptional support of our students, our world-renowned research, and our core values. The respect and compassion we have shown will show for all our colleagues affected by the VSIP, and the involuntary reduction in force reflects the very best of who we are as an institution. We're going to get rid of our best? No, you're not. You're trying to make them feel good about the fact they're getting their asses fired. The university will continue to keep you informed as we navigate this moment together. Please follow updates.duke.edu for additional information and resources. We appreciate your patience, resilience, and continued dedication to Duke's missions. Sincerely, Daniel G. Ennis, Executive Vice President, Alec D. Gallimore, Provost, and Mary E. Klotman, Executive Vice President for Health Affairs and Dean of Student Medicine. This email was sent to all faculty and staff, Duke University, 2080 Duke University Road. Jack was right again. Is that what I just heard in my own head? Jack was right again. That sounds like a corporation that's about to have its butt raped by a hostile acquisition. But there is no hostile acquirer. There is no new infusion of cat, like burn it down, take the guts out, and rebuild it. That's not happening here. Let me tell you something about this whole thing. Duke University is a major freaking university, right? I just covered the same kind of shit happening in USC without this level of detail last week. If you work for a major university and you've received something like this, I would love a copy. I promise, just as I did today, no one will ever know who the F you are, especially when they send it to all the faculty. For all they know, it's one of the people that already took the visa money and left. We don't know, do we? And Jack will never tell. I will never give a fucking source up. But this shit is going to, if it's happening to freaking USC, if it's happening to Duke, who's immune? Who's immune to this? Harvard, Yale, Princeton? Maybe. Because the name still carries weight and the network effect of going there still carries weight. But do you think they're going to continue their bullshit practices of letting people in just because they meet a certain DEI quota? They're not going to be able to afford that shit anymore. So they're going to have to change their practices, though they may stay more intact than what we'd call top level but second tier under the Ivies. But if Duke's not immune, then Texas State's not immune. Texas A&M's not immune. Freaking Georgia, Florida State, right? All these major schools, Baylor, et cetera, that people are happy to have up. None of these schools are immune to this. This is going to hit everybody, and it's going to hurt. And this is going to be a major layoff sector of the economy while the economy is growing. It probably won't be long before there's some kind of charity with sad music on your TV about helping a former college professor. I'm telling you. All right. So I don't like to give you problems without giving you solutions. And I'm telling you that for many, not all, okay, and it's important that you still understand that. If you want to be an engineer, you should go to college. You should shop around a bit and make sure that you're getting what you're paying for, but that's your path to being an engineer, especially like a high-level design engineer. Civil engineering with bridges and roads, any of that stuff. If you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a lawyer, and there's other jobs, there's other career paths that university still makes sense for. But the sheer number in does not reflect the number coming out with useful skills. And the value of the degree continues to go down while the cost of the degree grows up. This is a fake market, and fake markets always reach a terminal point where they have to rectify. And that's what's happening. And it's being triggered by a confluence of events, the rise of AI, and people realizing I don't need you for this basic shit anymore. Okay. It's also, a couple generations now of people looking at the young people older than them coming out with a degree and going to work for Starbucks or a bookstore or whatever and going, I don't want to go into $80,000-$100,000 worth of debt to do that. Or even when they have a good job, you're like, well, but did you need a degree for that job? Not really. Is it in your field of study? No, I don't want to do that. So that then there's just the population impact. People are just having less kids. We're just having less children. So then you just have less candidates to go in. And then at the same time, we have this fake artificial market. This market was created with an influx of trillions of dollars in money being lent to anyone who put their hand up and said they wanted to go to school and could get in. And they kept making it easier to get in. Like when I got out of high school in the 80s, it wasn't difficult to go to college, but there were plenty of people that couldn't, or like they could get into like community college or whatever. They couldn't get in to even a like third tier 4-year university. Like in Pennsylvania, like your big state schools are like Penn State, right? You big private institutions and stuff too. But then like your second tier state institutions like Bloomberg University and shit like that, right? Like today I bet you could be a sub 80 IQ and probably get into one of those. Right. Back in the 80s, like, if you weren't like a solid 3.5 GPA student with really good like SATs, it was difficult. If you were like a 3.1 and you had enough recommendations and you were really strong in your area of study, you could get in. But if you were a C, like a 2.9 GPA and a mediocre but decent SAT, you weren't getting into those schools. Now, anybody gets in almost anywhere except, you know, your Columbias, your Ivy Leagues and, you know, stuff like that. And so everybody gets in and all this fake money came in. Well, what does that do? It just makes this glut of people with degrees, useless degrees, by the way. So what does an employer say? You're not worth that much to me because you have a degree. It's just everybody has one. So there's nothing special about it. Something is valuable based on how rare it is. Right. If I know you like that, can't just be. Well, yeah, it is. Why is silver worth less than gold? In reality, like metallurgically, they're very, very similar. Gold has some industrial uses, but silver has more. They kind of weigh close to the same. They kind of have about the same hardness. They both can be really pretty and make jewelry. There's only one reason that gold is worth more than silver. There's less gold. And so if something is everywhere, you can't sell it for money. Do you think you can sell a bag of leaves in, let's say, Connecticut in October? Hey, it's good for composting. Get the fuck out of here. Like, there's leaves everywhere, idiot. They're all over there, right? But you know where you could sell that bag of leaves? In the desert. They want as much organic matter as they can get to build soil with. Because it's rare there, right? So we have this glut of degrees and this destruction of the value thereof. And the important takeaway from that can only happen in an artificially propped up system. You can't have the value of something go down while the price of it goes up in a market economy. It's not possible. You won't pay more for something that's worth less unless you have to have it. So what did they do? They pumped money into it and they let idiots borrow money for degrees that had no value, right? But they also did the important part on the marketing. They convinced at least three generations, okay, which I would say are Xers, millennials, and Gen Z, that you need college. You need it. And if you don't have it, you're going to be a dirt poor piece of shit your entire life. Just like that guy over there pushing a broom and cleaning your gum off the bottom of the desk because you didn't get in trouble today, you're going to be a janitor in a school. The person telling you that was a teacher in a school not making much more money than a fucking janitor. I'm just saying, right? I'm just saying. That's the truth. So they convinced people it was a need when it wasn't, and then they propped it up with money that was artificially created. And it all began in 71 when Nixon closed the window. Isn't that interesting how it all comes together? So the solution then is, well, if you are a young person today, or if you have young people in your life, and they're like, I want a good career. I want it to be resistant against artificial intelligence, at least to a degree. I want to be able to make damn good money, and I don't want to waste 4 years of my life in school. I'm willing to make less money in the beginning, but in the beginning, as I'm 18, 19 years old out of high school, I expect to make less money anyway. You know, most people come out of high school, if they take a job right away, they're going to work retail or something like that. What are the 10 of, because they're not necessarily the 10, but 10 of the best places to look into as a young person? What does it pay after 5 years median? Okay. And how do you get into it? That's what I have for you today. And before I give them to you, I want to tell you what median means. Median doesn't mean average. Average means we take all the numbers, add them up and divide them by the total number. That's average. Median is exactly 50% of people in the cohort are better and 50% are worse. It's the dead center of everything. It's a little different than an average. But to me, it's more indicative of if you are good and you work hard, the money you can expect to make. Because the bottom people drag the average down. The median is what anybody who's decent can expect to make this much or more after 5 years. Elevator and escalator installer repairer. Median salary after 5 years, $106,000 a year. It's a rigorous 4-year paid apprenticeship, and it's often union sponsored. So that's where you would look for that to get into that line of work. electrical power line installer and repair. That would be a lineman. 5-year median salary, $92,500 plus. Start high school diploma or GED, then a 2 to 4 year apprenticeship through utility or a union is what you look for in that. And again, I want to point out, these are median salaries based on a regular work week, and many of these jobs have huge potential to make more money with overtime, okay? Pipe fitter, steam fitter, $70,000 to $100,000 plus at 5 years median. To get started, you need a 4 to 5 year apprenticeship, which is almost always union-based, okay? Electrician, $60,000 to $70,000 is a median salary for a journeyman electrician with 5 years of experience. Start high school diploma, GED, then a 4 to 5 year apprenticeship. And those are actually, they're out there. If you can't find one, you're not looking hard enough. HVAC tech, $60,000 to $70,000 experienced at 5 years. Start high school diploma, GED, trade school, 6 months to 2 years, and an apprenticeship plus EPA certification. Okay. Heavy equipment operator, $55,000 to $70,000 median with 5 years of experience, high school diploma, GED, on-the-job training, or vocational program. Plumber, $60,000 to $1,000 median, 5 years as a journeyman. Start high school diploma, GED, and a 4 to 5 year apprenticeship. There's a shitload of people coming out of college right now, and they ain't starting a job making that kind of money, and they have no experience, and they need to get experience. I'm just saying. Welders. You guys are like, come on, say welder. Okay. Especially specialized welders. Like, you're not just a welder. You're a welder specialized in some niche, right? 70 to 100,000 plus. Start high school diploma, GED, technical program, and certifications like AWS. And I'm going to tell you right now, I know welders. Now, these guys are working some overtime, serious overtime. And it's not the greatest environment at all. But I know guys right now that are welding out in the oil fields in West Texas. They have all their own equipment, trailers, et cetera, and they're knocking down 150 to 180 a year as welders. And some of them couldn't have begged their way into a college, but they're really good at what they do, and they're dependable, and they show up on time, and that's all that matters out there. Carpenters, 60 to 75,000 plus, start high school diploma, GED, then 3 to 4 year apprenticeship. None of those are bad. None of those are terrible incomes, and that's at 5 years median. So the person who truly excels, that wants to work for the best companies in the best markets, they can make a ton of money. Rodney says, I made $118,000 last year as an equipment operator in a gravel pit. Yet it's lots of overtime, but I'm 80% of union wage at $51 an hour. So there's a guy, works in a gravel pit, running heavy equipment, $118,000 last year. I gave you a number. This just tells you my numbers are, if anything, conservative. I wasn't, you know, gilding the lily here. My number for that job is 55 to 70,000 plus. I went conservative. So am I saying that you should go into any of these career fields? I am not. I don't tell people what to do with their lives. Your dash is precious. The most important capital in your life is time and what you do with it. You need to decide for yourself. What I'm saying is we need to stop lying to young people that your life will just be dog shit if you don't have a degree. Because it's not true, right? It's not that I just hate universities. On some levels I do, and on some levels I see value in them. It all, I feel like the university system is something that had a really defined, clear agenda that was absolutely valuable to society as a whole until about 1970, and we all kind of know what went wrong there. And that's when everything just went off the fucking rails, because when you pervert the incentives of a system, the system will become perverse. And when you got into a situation, I mean, you guys understand, you go back to the 60s and back, almost nobody paid to go to college. The first people that in earnest paid to go to college were GIs after World War II, because they had money to go with. Most people before World War II, so now we're going back to the 30s and back, if you went to college, it was all paid for with endowments. It was all paid by alumni money. There were people selected, like, this person can do university work. This person has a great future. And you could go to college for almost nothing or for nothing. Now, people did pay their way in who weren't selected through that process. But and that's why when they gave the GIs money with the Army College Fund, right, and the GI Bill, that's why they had the ability to use it that way. But most people, so that made the number of people coming out of that system relatively small to the total number of people in the country. More people didn't have a degree than did have a degree, is what I'm saying. And if you think about it, that makes sense. That makes sense, because look at any standard office. How much do most of the people that work in that office actually need a degree? You go back to the 1800s and coming into the 1920s, from that, like after the Civil War up until the 1920s, it was very common that CEOs of major corporations may have started as runners for companies as teenagers, like running product around and or working in the mailroom or being a messenger boy. And the guy just stuck around. And if he got a job when he was 15 and he was still there at 20, like, we need to find something to do with this guy. This guy's loyal. And they just worked their way up in the companies. And this was common even into the 80s, just not as common as it was back then. My father-in-law, God rest his soul, ended up a VP of a dairy. Now, I mean, this is not like just a place that milks cows. This was like, you know, a whole, like a regional chain of convenience stores. He came to the United States right after World War II, about 1950, after he finished up his time with the Royal Marines. He was a Dutch Marine. And so when he got out, he wanted to come to America. And because of some things his father did during the war, he was kind of fast-tracked in with his new wife. They came here. He barely spoke English. And, you know, 15 years later, he's a vice president of operations for a large company. No college. That was very common because you don't need college to do that job. But even if you did, all the people in it that push paper around and shit, they don't need it either. We defaulted to it because of a surplus. It's time for us to accept that we fucked this up. Among a thousand other things we fucked up, what I gave you today is one potential solution to this problem. There's 100 others. There's make sure you get a degree that's valuable if you're going to do it. You know, my nephew is an assistant attorney general in Nebraska right now. He graduated from a top law school. His specialty is environmental law, and he's handling cases that are state versus state, like Colorado versus Nebraska type cases. You can't do that without the degree in the law school. You can't, right? You can't be a surgeon without a degree, plus medical school, plus an internship, plus a residency, and on some levels, a fellowship. And that's good, because if somebody's going to remove my kidneys and put somebody else's kidneys in my body, I want them to go through a rigorous process. But somebody that's going to work in HR and send out memos doesn't need it. I'm sorry, Karen, you don't need your degree. It's time that we wake up to this nonsense. Anyway, with that wrapped up, let's remind you guys one of the ways you can help support my show is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I don't have an item of the day for you, but I'm going to push my book. A lot of the stuff that you hear on this show, a lot of the things that really, you know, are where the rubber hits the road, the things that made me a success in my life without a college degree are in this book. This book is just under 200 pages of the hard-fought lessons that I learned working my way up from absolute dog shit nothing. I got out of the Army in 1993. I took a walk on the Appalachian Trail from Pennsylvania to New Hampshire to get my brain back in the right mode. I threw all my shit in a $400 car. I drove here to Texas. My car broke down on the side of the road the day that I got here. And I stayed with a friend and slept on his couch and paid half his rent for sleeping on the couch. My first jobs were breaking tires down at a Firestone and throwing people out of bars as a bouncer. By the time, two and a half years from that, I was making six figures. And I didn't do one of those apprenticeships that I talked about or anything like that either. That's not something you just do. You have to have a plan. And you have to develop kind of guideposts along the way. That's what laws of life is. They're not laws because I say they're laws. They're laws because of the way the world works. All I did with this book is I tried to codify them in a way that would make them easy to understand and adapt. I'm also right now working on Laws of Life 2, though I don't know if that'll be the title of the book. It's a 16-chapter book, and I am done with six chapters in full, including editing, because I've learned my lesson, and I'm editing as I go this time instead of editing when I'm done. So I expect that book will be out before the end of the year. But get this one now. Send it to that young person that you really wish would just take life a little bit more seriously, but also maybe they want to, but they just don't know how. They don't know what direction to take in life. This book doesn't tell you what to do. It tells you how to think so that you can figure out what you want to do for yourself. And the most important thing it does is it teaches you a lesson that we've stopped teaching. We call it critical thinking, but I use a metaphor in the book of programming and writing code for your supercomputer. Your supercomputer is not ChatGPT. It's the 3 pounds of fat inside your skull, your brain. It's the most advanced computer in the world. It can do things that no AI unit can ever do. We are the primary coder for that computer, but we have been trained to program the brain with junk, garbage, bullshit code. This book, in every chapter, gives you mental code rewrites, how to change the programming that you're putting into your own brain so you become less susceptible to bullshit, figure out what you want, and hopefully become unstoppable in going out and getting it. You want to give a young person in your life a gift. That would be a great one. And if you want to give yourself a gift, again, become a member of the MSP. That's the number one way I pay for everything. My server bill's almost $1,000 a month. Just so people can download the show, right? Because of the number of listeners. That's not a bad problem to have, by the way. I'm just saying I can't do this for free. And I also never wanted it to be like, hey, please give me. I didn't want to be like an e-beggar, right? Like, please give me money. I wanted a program where I could have a high profit margin, but you would be better off for buying it than not buying it. That's what MSB is. That's why you have these huge discounts to so many cool things that you're probably buying anyway, so you can get your money back. And right now, $35 a year, rate locks in for as long as you don't cancel, that rate locks in for life. And that includes, like, if something goes wrong and the card doesn't get charged or something, you email me, I'll give you your rate back. That's just I've always done that for any time I've ever run a sale. $35 a year I'm telling you, there's discounts in there. You use them once, you pay for a year, two, or three, one-time use. That's value. That's what I build. That's what I've always tried to bring to this audience. Appreciate everybody today. I know we went a little bit late today. Mondays, I'm always behind the bear a little bit, but today was even more so. But maybe it was good. We had a pretty good turnout today, and that's probably because since we were later, people that normally couldn't be here could. Thank you all for tuning in. Tomorrow we'll have another Just Jack show. And we have a kick-ass interview this week, but it just went out of my brain who it is. We got a pretty good interview coming this week, too. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with another one. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.